This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. If there's two phrases we hear all the time these days, they are social justice and identity politics. Those phrases are usually identified with the progressive left, but today's guest on the Reason Podcast actually worries that social justice and identity politics are having a pernicious effect on the conservative right and, in fact, all of American politics. Sitting with me is Noah Rothman. He's an associate editor of Commentary Magazine, a contributor to MSNBC, and the author of the very provocative new book, Unjust: Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. We're going to talk to him about his book, Contemporary Politics, Trump, as well as Never Trumpers, particularly on the conservative side of the aisle, and his career, which is getting on there in years. So, and because we're recording this in my living room in Lower Manhattan, just a stone's throw from where CBGB used to be, on a very loud and busy intersection, there is going to be a lot of sirens and shouts and jackhammers and screams in the background, because that's what this neighborhood in New York is like. So I'm just warning you, be ready for, you know, if you hear screams, don't worry, we've already alerted the cops. Noah, welcome to the Reason Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So let's start talking about Unjust. You write early on that the American tradition of political idealism is empowered by a growing obsession with the demographic categories of race, sex, ethnicity, and sexual orientation, the primary categories that are now supposed to constitute identity. Flesh that out a little bit and explain why it worries you.
Yeah, so if you were to argue against identity politics in total, you're arguing against human nature, and I'm not trying to fight the tide. Identity is construed in many ways. Identity politics is a really overbroad term. It doesn't really constitute anything that you can grab a hold of, but it's increasingly less applied to class and socioeconomic distinctions, right, which was previously how you would understand identity politics in most of the 20th century, and now it's much more construed as your demographic traits inherited at birth, mm-hmm. Your race, ethnicity, creed, gender, and sexual preference. And that is what is constituting identity politics. And this book is about how identity politics manifests in practice. Social justice, as it's currently constituted by its advocates, which, as you say, are mostly on the left. The book is primarily mm-hmm. about the left, but not exclusively. The right is increasingly attracted to these ideas. And in practice, that is, social justice has become an alternative theory of societal organization to the American founding ideal, which is essentially meritocracy, egalitarianism, and what have you.
And kind of a rule of law in the sense of equal opportunity and treating people equally under the law.
As like, individuals.
Right. Yeah.
And social justice prescribes a much more collective ideal of,
based on the identities you're talking about, which are typically race, gender, sexual orientation, but not so much class.
Less class, although that's a focus for much of the old left.
Right.
But the new left, the new left,
right,
as it were,
yeah,
has sort of embraced a much more narrow definition
of
identity.
Well, you know, just to, before we go on to some specific examples of stuff that you think is particularly troubling, you write also that identity has always been important in American politics, but that it, so people care about where they come from. Everybody has a story, and that's part of being an individual, is that, you know, you come from this, your parents come from this country, or you grew up here, or you had this experience, and it forms you. But you say that the problem now is that identity needs a limiting principle. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so a couple things I open up with in the book is this is not an attack on self-actualization or mm-hmm. racial awareness. To argue that would be to argue from a position of ignorance, and that is not what I am doing. I illustrate sort of the themes in the book in an introductory anecdote that I obtained while I was on a junket to Ukraine, a government-sponsored trip to Ukraine, and we were seated across the chief prosecutor from the country, who was explaining to us in perfect English, but rather pointedly, why it was not in their interest, and certainly then not in our interest, for them to prosecute individuals who are engaged in violence in the Maidan Revolution on their side. And why should we want that? We're all on the same team. And that, to me, was no definition of justice that I was familiar with, it was a lot more like revenge. And that is how social justice is increasingly construed and applied in the real world, is that it prescribes seeing individuals not as individuals, but as members of their collective tribe, of their collective class, and that those classes benefit from or suffer from historical conditions of which they may not even be aware. And so those conditions need to be addressed. And usually it takes the form of negative discrimination, of downward social leveling, in a paradigmatic sense.
Yeah, so give a concrete example of what you're talking about.
A concrete example, I think, probably the best illustration of how this manifests in the real world is the status quo that emerged from the post-2011 Dear Colleague letter that Barack Obama's administration wrote to colleges outlining the ways in which they should prosecute alleged incidents of sexual violence on campus. And this illustrates the social justice mindset because it redefined justice more broadly. The ideal here is that the American system of justice is simply ill-equipped to adjudicate conditions or accusations of sexual violence because they define the condition too narrowly, and also because they impose conditions on the accused that are manifestly unjust, that they force these individuals to confront their accuser, which can be traumatic, that they force them to present excessive
evidence. You mean that the accuser, they put stuff on the accuser.
Right. So somebody who is an alleged victim must confront their alleged tormentor. And that is a traumatic experience for them, obviously. And it is. And that they must present a overwhelming evidentiary burden in order to present their cases. And so in these campus tribunals that were organized, the burden of evidence was much lower. A preponderance of evidence standard, which is for civil trials and not criminal trials, was applied. And often when these verdicts, quote unquote, were found their way into a real courtroom, it was found that the individuals, both accused and accuser, had their First, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights abridged. As a result of this redefinition, this rebooting of justice in order to achieve a much more collective and empathetic view of sexual violence from the position of somebody who is the alleged victim of sexual violence. But in so doing, they created a whole slew of new victims. And that's not justice. It's something much different.
So you write that the rise of identity politics or identitarianism and its use of social justice ends badly because what began, and I'm quoting here, as a humbling and enlightening quest for racial and cultural awareness has become a competition among victimized classes to determine who is the most oppressed and to capitalize on that status. What's an example of that, that's kind of kicking around the...
So in the chapter on the increasing appeal of victimization narratives, I describe the ways in which this has become currency and the rewards associated with achieving a status, a legitimate status of victimization. And this has become, I've gotten a lot of pushback on this from African-American social justice activists who I speak with, because there is evidence increasingly of hate crime hoaxes perpetrated increasingly by individuals who claim to be the victims of those hate crime hoaxes.
So this is something where, somebody's dorm room or car or property gets...
Or the Air Force Academy, which is a very prominent example.
Gets vandalized or epithets are written on things like that. Or
churches defaced, burned down. The notion there being that there is this plague of racial, transphobic, homophobic, misogynistic violence that is targeting these individuals. And increasingly, you have these incidences in which these episodes are fabricated by the individual who claims to be the victim of that. Now, there are obviously real examples of this kind of hatred and real hate crimes, and that sort of thing should be the focus of somebody who's really genuinely interested in highlighting these episodes and trying to stigmatize them and make sure that they don't happen anymore. But you see, more often than not, when I bring this up, a frustration with just identifying the fact that these hate crimes happen, because it's in their mind, I think, they believe that it can be used by individuals with a pernicious intent to delegitimize real, genuine episodes of racial violence. But in my mind, it should be precisely the opposite. These people should be absolutely horrified by these episodes of false racial violence.
Not the perpetrators of the frauds, but aren't other people in the community who are, who are ostensibly, part of the victim class? If you're a person of color who's trans, don't they get pissed off when somebody runs a fraud or a hoax on their behalf?
Well, they certainly should. I wish I saw more of it, and I believe they do. But in the commentary class, what you see more is an instinct to protect the narrative than to push back on these episodes, in part because they could be used legitimately by people who are predisposed to dismiss this as a real threat.
So this, at one point you talk about the inversion of a kind of Plato, Platonic noble lie,
right,
where people will say, well, you know, this is a hoax, but it's in the service of a larger truth or a higher truth. So we don't want to actually give that much. We don't want to talk about the hoaxes because we're afraid it'll undermine our, you know,
yeah,
the larger goal that we're seeking.
But the Platonic ideal there is to sow social cohesion by virtue of this false
right
premise. The objective here is to sow discohesion, to sow disunity in order to advance individual group claims. And so you have to wonder, why is this happening so often? And I submit that is because there's a cost-benefit analysis being made here, that as we increase the amount of reward associated with a status of victimization, that you have a proliferation of claims to that status. It's
so
a supply-demand issue.
Yeah, what are some of the rewards that come with that? What are some of the rewards of, you know, identifying as a a black person who's trans?
Well, on campus, for example, when you are a victim of one of these high profile hate crimes, you are afforded a whole lot of attention. You benefit from a lot of sympathy, and that can be psychically rewarding. There are marches organized in your favor. There are protests in your favor. You generate a lot of attention and sympathy, and it's rewarding for people, obviously, as it probably should be. However, when these claims are found to be false, there's obviously usually a downside in the form of criminal charges, because you more often than not have made a false charge or false statement to police. But there's less and less stigmatization associated with that category because of the fear on the part of individuals who believe that this is a real crisis, a real epidemic, that people who are of pernicious intent can take these episodes and use them to delegitimize real, genuine episodes of racial discrimination. That's a perverse incentive structure.
Where is this coming from? In the book, you tie it to John Rawls and to Marx on a certain level. Like one of the things that I think is genuinely praiseworthy in your book is that you actually are not simply cataloging, you know, stuff that we all read online every day of, you know, this thing turns out to be a fraud or this or that or whatever. Discuss how Rawls and Marx are kind of informing this in your analysis.
Yeah, so social justice has a real philosophical foundation that I'm not even sure many of its advocates are wholly aware of. It comes out of the Catholic Church in the late 19th century. It was designed by the Catholic Church as sort of an answer to the secular Protestant Enlightenment, and it was more or less at the time a theory of charity, just a way to think about your obligations to your fellow man. Although there were some collectivist themes in, for example, the Rerum Novarum, which is really the origins of modern social justice
theory.
Without
getting diverted, I am a lapsed Catholic or a recovering Catholic, and the Catholic Church, particularly in the 19th century, is an interesting kind of shit show, because they were anti-capitalist, they were anti-communist, but they were also anti-democracy. I mean,
sure,
it's not an individualistic organization. But
absolutely not. And so in the late 1960s, early 1970s, a philosopher named John Rawls put some meat on these bones and sort of helped us think about social justice as a way to achieve historical redress for discrimination and prejudice in the past, about as thinking of justice as sort of a finite commodity. And it exists in the world, there's no supply chain, and in order to have a just distribution of that justice, you needed to have enlightened distributors who would do the distribution. But in order to have that, you had to create this theoretical construct called the veil of ignorance. So the enlightened distributor operates behind a blindfold, and that he would not be aware of the individuals who were benefiting from or suffering from his distribution. So his biases, conscious or otherwise, could not be satisfied. The modern social justice activist has no use for the veil of ignorance. Mm-hmm. They abandon the veil of ignorance because it's morally obtuse. How can you have an enlightened and just distribution of justice unless you know who are the beneficiaries of your distribution? Who are the oppressed? Who are their oppressors? Who needs to be lifted up and who needs to have a come up? sense, in a collective sense, in a historical sense. The Marxian aspects of this is really limited to the theory of intersectionality.
So
a really popular.
Yeah, define that. I mean, intersectionality is a theory or a concept that was developed a couple decades ago in feminist scholarship. Talk a little bit about that and how that intersects with this.
Yeah, so this is a perfectly valid academic way to understand how prejudice manifests in the real world, developed by and formalized by Kimberly Williams Crenshaw. And it stipulates that you are born with certain traits that are distinct from everybody else, that you have certain traits inherently that are more discriminated against or less discriminated against than everybody else. So you might have certain traits that are historically more discriminated against. Like, if, for example, if you're an African-American woman, you will experience more prejudice than an African-American man, because men experience less prejudice in the world than women do.
Again, this, of course, is the subtext of a John Lennon song that is John Lennon and Yoko Ono song that is no longer able to be played. It's called Woman is the N-word of the World.
Oh, right.
Because she's, think about it, she's the slave to the world's slaves.
Yeah.
So
again, I mean, it's a valid way to think about discrimination. These discriminatory paradigms overlap, they intersect.
And that opera in the background is just street noise. So
we have that too. Yeah. We're up in the 40s. And so we get the fire trucks.
Okay,
too.
So intersectionality, you know, argues that people have different identities that neither fully define themselves, but they kind of layer up, and that in order to understand somebody's situation in the world, you need to take into account all of the different aspects and how those kind of add up.
And that's really important.
Yeah.
As a political organizing theory, however, it has a lot of inherent defects that I think render it really less useful than its adherents believe it to be. Sort of the Marxian aspect of this is that it's valid and useful as a political organizing tool because it unites disparate claims of discrimination and struggles against discrimination and prejudice into one organizing principle. For Marx, the source of all conflict was class. Mm-hmm. For intersectional theorists, it's identity and the various forms in which it takes. And the manifestation of that as a political organizing principle is probably most evident in how the women's march tore itself apart. Mm-hmm. So as a practicing intersectional theorist, you cannot really view your allies as your allies, not in whole, because they possess different demographic traits than you do. You inhabit this matrix of persecution, and somebody who deals with less persecution than you is necessarily somebody you need to educate. And so the Women's March attacked its Jewish members, specifically its white Jewish members, because they were perpetuating white supremacy, whether they knew it or not. And that robbed them of some allies on that side of the intersectional spectrum. Also, the movement felt compelled to embrace people that had little to no political constituency whatsoever, people like Assata Shakur, who's a convicted cop killer living a fugitive from justice in Cuba.
In this part of the country, we know her better as Joanne Chesimard.
That's what her name appeared on the court documents. And people like Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Yeah, that will let's I think these are separate but related things. But first, on the intersectionality. So you had with the Women's March, and there was this long story in Tablet magazine, which then was essentially rewritten by the New York Times, et cetera. But where a couple of the early organizers who were Jewish, who were white women, heterosexual, and they realized they wanted to have a kind of inclusive top, you know, commandant class, you know. And so they brought in a bunch of people, some of whom were Muslim American, some of whom were black, some of whom were trans or whatever. And then they were kind of told, okay, well, like, hey, you know, as a white woman, you don't get to talk as much at the Women's March now because this is our time. And that's the intersectionality thing, where it's like what Dave Chappelle has referred to as the oppression Olympics of like, well, because I'm a woman, I, you know, have I'm from a minority that is particularly set upon, whether that's black, if I'm a black Muslim, that's, you know, those are extra points. If my sexual orientation is off, like I have more points, so I get to speak more, and your job here is to just kind of be there and do what I need you to do.
Yeah, that's not new either. The Occupy Wall Street movement adopted something called the Progressive Stack, which identified its members by their demographic traits, whether they were white, male, what have you, that they had typically privileged traits that benefit from historical conditions. And they were told that they have to sit back, that they cannot speak or they cannot address. They have to wait their turn, sit back, shut up, watch their privilege. And that manifested in this really humiliating episode, by the way, when I think it was John Lewis tried to address one of these Occupy demonstrations.
So this is the congressman who was famously civil beaten during the Civil Rights March. I mean, bloodied.
Yeah. And he was treated to a humiliating display in which these little activists, who probably didn't know who they were talking to, debated amongst themselves whether it was valid or not that he should address them because of his racial background, whether his racial background should privilege him to address this revolutionary demonstration, because if he were to address the revolutionary demonstration, he would be legitimizing them in the eyes of the leadership class. But because of his race, perhaps he should. It was humiliating and embarrassing. And eventually, he didn't address this demonstration. He just sort of shuffled off sheepishly.
So you can see how, you know, this is, I mean, it almost becomes satirical, like a self-satire of where, in the end, only one person can speak, and that's the person who, you know, has collected all of the possible oppression points or something like that.
But, and that's why the Women's March felt inclined to embrace, or its leaders at least, felt inclined to embrace people like Shakur and Farrakhan, because to abandon them would be to legitimize the prejudices against which they say they struggle.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask, because, you know, the one thing of the logic of intersectionality, I could see that where it's kind of like, hey, you know, hey, white boy, you know, you're, and like, maybe you're pissed off. You're at a magazine, you know, that is, you know, was originally created by, you know, Jewish intellectuals after World War II. And like, you know, you guys had a hell of a run, and now it's other people's turn to, you know, to talk. It's other people. We want to hear other people's stories. So just shut the fuck up for a little bit. I mean, there's something to that. The odd thing, which I'm not sure what explains this, is then, okay, so there's that. But then, you know, Louis Farrakhan, I don't, you know, like, just why he is like, and his, particularly his anti-Semitism, which gets a pass, not throughout all of the black intellectual class, and not throughout many liberal people. I mean, like, most people don't, you know, have any respect for Louis Farrakhan. But is there a necessary connection between kind of intersectionality and anti-Semitism? Because that does seem to be what was coming out in something like the Women's March.
Yeah, I'm not sure. As far as it's sort of difficult to identify all the intersecting prejudices that are make up this hierarchy of demographics and racial traits, but Jewishness and Semitism does seem to rank pretty low for its adherence.
Well, that's because Jews, to their credit, have and I don't want to say to their, because I'm an individualist, I'm a libertarian, but obviously Jews as a group have done phenomenally well despite, you know, facing a lot of barriers and historic and systemic attempts to keep them out of places.
I mean, in this country, sure.
No, that's what I'm saying here. And actually throughout the world, I mean, you know, on a certain level, you can say that with obvious exceptions, but it's,
perhaps, I mean, yeah. I this isn't in the book, I'd just be speculating, but perhaps because they are generally, by and large, with some pretty prominent exceptions, a success story that they have sort of achieved escape velocity from this paradigm that would prescribe in thinking of yourself as a victim inhabiting a matrix of persecution that you cannot escape without the help of enlightened liberal Sherpas who will help you navigate this complex matrix of persecution.
Well, but you know, it's also interesting to think about Jews as unassimilable. Like, this is the charge against them, that, like, you know, they're always going to have a second, you know, they're always going to have a second loyalty. And they can never, simultaneously racist, and certainly, you know, people like Nazis and anti-Semites in America would say, well, Jews can never really be American, fully American. There's something about them that is essentially foreign.
They used to say the same thing about Catholics.
But Jews have, you know, they maintain tighter, they don't outmarry as much, they maintain their odd customs and traditions, and they're successful, and their numbers are so small.
And shrinking.
It's kind of interesting to think about how they are in many ways aspirational of, say, Nation of Islam. I mean, you know, because they have the Nation of Islam has a whole crackpot theory about how, you know, they're the real Jews. and you know that Jews are so-called Jews and they're fake Jews, and that they are the lost tribe of Israel. And so there's this bizarre kind of projection onto Jews, the hatred for like robbing them of their identity, which you know then they want really bad. It just gets
Very confusing. I mean, it's important to understand all this, and it's valid as a subject of study, but as a psychological place to inhabit, it's really dangerous. Yeah. I mean, it's the sort of thing that creates these, you know, mood disorders.
You know, on a certain level, I mean, part of it is the intellectual, you know, kind of inheritance of or legacy of somebody like Rawls and kind of the ways that his theories of justice get applied. You know, but what is fueling it? Because it seems, you know, and this might be a incredibly naive statement on my part, but you know, when you look at all of the broad, brutal kind of categories of racism, of sexism, of kind of class-based oppression, we seem to be getting closer and closer to the end of those things. I mean, women compared to 50 years ago, blacks compared to 50 years ago, homosexuals, you know, I mean, gay people, it's like it's mind, you know, it blows your mind to think about how much better we are as a society in just accepting people for who they are, et cetera. And so am I wrong to think that there's something odd going on where we seem to be getting rid of the most obvious forms of this type of class-based, oppression, and at the same time, the reaction to what remains just is going through the roof?
I don't think you're wrong at all, and that's one of the things that I stipulate in the book, and that's the reaction to a statement like that is outrage and frustration and anger.
Because we can't admit that there's been any progress for some reason.
Yeah, well, you can't because it would empower people who they don't want to empower, people who genuinely dismiss racism, subtle or otherwise, and point to racial progress or whatever progress as to exemplify their point. And they think that it diminishes the cause of anti-discrimination. And it could, but that doesn't render this truth less valid.
Right.
You know, just because if objectivity becomes the enemy of a political program, it's not objectivity that has to go. Mm-hmm. So when you have that kind of a emotional response to these demonstrable truths, it's much more of a religious approach to thinking. These are inviolable ideals. They're not really there's no real evidence to support them. They are faith-based constructs, and so I treat this a lot like a theology. It strikes me much more as a religious conviction.
What is the role of commentary? We're going to talk a little bit more about commentary and your career and the places that you've written. Is a conservative magazine, and you know, back in the early 60s or whatever, there's you know the most famous article probably written in commentary is by Norman Podhoretz, the father of the current editor, My Negro Problem and Ours. And, you know, conservatives were freaked out by claims by blacks for, you know, and it wasn't just commentary. National Review was kind of putting up half-hearted defenses of both de jure as well as de facto segregation until the late 60s. You know, they were always like, well, you know, yeah, you know, I realize, you know, blacks, you've got problems and you've got legitimate grievances, but you got to slow down or you got to take it easy. You know, I mean, is it partly that people are just kind of fed up? I mean, this is, you know, a letter from Birmingham jail where Martin Luther King is saying, you know, people are saying, hey, you know, just wait a little bit, you know, take it easy. And it's like, fuck it. You know, like, I've only got this life to live.
Yeah, the critics of this approach to thinking about social justice issues would cite civil rights era thinking and commentary and who was on the right and wrong side of history there. And that's perfectly valid. But I think the distinction there is that we're talking about anti-discrimination efforts. Mm-hmm. Currently, what manifests in modern social justice thinking is not anti-discrimination efforts, but pro-discrimination efforts, mm-hmm. just the right kind of discrimination, a negative sort of discrimination, a downward social leveling. No longer are we talking about individuals whose individual mitigating circumstances or extenuating circumstances should allow them to be lifted up by institutions. It's much more creating institutions that would create a downward pressure on the groups and tribes that deserve it.
So in what order does to that achieve. Mean? That means, I mean, so in that way, it's, well, I guess this is maybe not the perfect example, but it's kind of Harvard keeping Asian Americans out.
I think it's a great example because the people who defend this program in the New York Times opinion page, for example, appeal to stereotypes in order to justify it. They say, well, you know, Asian Americans, they might come from an immigrant family, so they have that little intersectional plus going for them. But on the minus side, they come from stable homes, usually. They have a traditional work ethic in their culture that allows them to advance much more so than the individuals around them who have less of these traits. And so we're abandoning the idea that these people are people, that they're individuals with individual circumstances.
I always find it, you know, whenever, and my family's background, all of my grandparents were immigrants. My mother's family was from Italy and my father's family was from Ireland. But when you say Asian Americans, like when I went to college was the first time where I had grown up with some Chinese people, but I had never met Koreans or Japanese people. And then I realized, like, well, these are all very distinct cultures, right. Every bit as much as Irish versus Italian versus Jewish versus Caribbean, you know, and they really, I mean, it's amazing the quickness with which we're willing to say, oh, well, Asian Americans constitute a real thing in the same way we do with Latinos. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey and, you know, the difference between Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, and Cubans were, you know, giant, certainly among themselves.
Yeah, and there are certainly collective distinctions here to be made, but there is no society that you can build around these ideas that resembles an egalitarian meritocratic society. And, you know, when you talk to a social justice activist, particularly on the left, and you invoke the American ideal, they get equally frustrated along with the you know, similar theocratic notions, because what they know of the American ideal is correct, that we have never lived up to it. And that's true, but that's also a misunderstanding of what an ideal is. An ideal is aspirational. It is utopian to say you will live up to an ideal. It's no longer an ideal then. It's just an organizing principle.
Talk about, in the book, you bring up Friedrich Hayek's deconstruction of the term social justice. How does that play out, and why is that useful to your analysis?
Well, he was an adversary of just about everything social.
He actually in his work was committed to what he called methodological individualism, so that it became anything social, or, you know, it implies a collective, so it gets problematic very quickly for him.
And I guess to distill his very broad and comprehensive response to Rawlsian thought down to a single sentence, it would essentially be that if you were to apply Rawlsian thought in the real world, if you were to create these institutions that he said should be dedicated to the distribution of justice, you are by necessity creating an institution that has to treat individuals unequally in the pursuit of equality. And once you've done that, you've created an institution that is, by the Rawlsian definition, unjust. It will never create a just institution, because an institution is, by virtue, imperfect. It is created by the hands of man, and anything that created by the hands of man is necessarily only as good as its inputs, and its inputs are flawed. So these institutions will be engaged in an unjust pursuit the very minute they begin to pursue social justice, and therefore it is a flawed concept. It simply cannot achieve what it wants to achieve. It will always fail on its own merits.
So one of the particularly interesting things about the book to me, and this, you're working in a rich tradition of people within, kind of, you know, broadly speaking, either the right or the conservative movement, to critique members of your own kind of tribe, broadly speaking. And you talk about how all of this idea about victimization and social justice and identity politics is actually showing up among conservatives and right-wingers. And you write that Donald Trump's ascendancy revealed that victimization has bipartisan appeal. What's going on with Trump and, you know, kind of Trump-tardian embrace of victimization? Because that is one of the hallmarks of a kind of the way Trump talks is, you know, he's a billionaire and all that, but he's beleaguered. Everybody's constantly, you know, poking him in the ribs.
Yeah, and he would appeal to these themes on the campaign trail in 2016, essentially that arguing that your lot is not of your own making, that you have been robbed of that which is your due by ill-defined forces, unseen in places that you can't accurately describe. That
China.
Well, China, right, sure. Right, I mean, yeah.
Global elites,
Chinese competition, foreign labor, the global economy, what have you. All these forces are acting to keep you down. And as a result, you're not really responsible for your own conditions. And that kind of absolution for your own conditions in life is empowering in a way, even though it's wildly disempowering. It provides you with some sort of exculpation for your own choices.
Well,
it
reminds me of a kind of in AA parlance, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you only gain control over your drinking when you say I'm powerless over drinking. It's a weird thing to say, like, I become powerful when I say I am not responsible for my lot in life. I'm a victim.
Again, a very religious thought. Yeah. You're surrendering to a higher power. You are surrendering to this current and giving up a lot of agency in the process. And that is antithetical to the conservative ideal, properly understood, which really advocates an absolutist view of individual agency. But it is a powerful organizing
force.
Which
is kind of bizarre, though, right? I mean, if you're saying that individuals, I mean, we may, as a kind of existential fact, we're responsible for, you know, our lives, for living our lives, but we're not. You know, I mean, if you or I have been born 20 or 30 or 40 years in the past or in the future or in, you know, Mali,
sure,
you know, we would be very different people.
And that's Rawlsian thought. I mean, his claim is basically that you as an individual want to be born into certain conditions in certain places because those conditions are better than others. Right. That's an objective truth.
And we should try to accord everybody the same opportunities. Right.
So you have to do things and create institutions to maximize equality as much as you possibly can. And insofar as you don't impose on somebody else's justice, you know, you create the maximum beneficial distribution as much as you can, then you've achieved that kind of a justice. The absolutist view of agency, however, as a psychological precept, as a way to navigate your life, and, you know, obviously there are disparate circumstances that individuals face, and disparate societies present individuals with disparate circumstances, and some are better than others. But if you approach life with the idea that, by and large, you have control over your own conditions and your circumstances, you're going to be better off at the end of the day than somebody who surrenders to the tide and perceives themselves to be hostage to to forces that they cannot control.
So is the alt-right the, you know, it's kind of like a mirror image of the identitarian politics that you're talking about?
So much so that it's a distinction I largely declined to draw. They're identitarian. They discuss with fervent passion their own identity, their own victimization. They have a philosophical ethos that is very much akin to social justice on the left. Their philosophers are still in the dark, in part because they realize accurately that their ideology is stigmatized and repulsive. But it's a totalitarian ideal. It's resentful of democracy. It's resentful of meritocracy.
Some great, I want to call it reporting, but it's more like, you know, reminders of what was going on. You mentioned the Occupy Wall Street movement and in Zuccotti Park. And, that there was like a nightmarish war of all against all within Occupy, obviously the Charlottesville rally, which one hopes was the high water mark of the alt-right, because once they showed who they were, you know, I think even people who might have put up with them are like, who the fuck are these people? But what does it feel like, as a person working at, you know, one of the premier Jewish publications, Jewish culturally or traditionally, when you see, you know, guys walking around with tiki torches saying Jews will not replace us?
I mean, it's not great, but I'm equally horrified by the individuals who engage in violence in the pursuit of so-called anti-fascist ideals. These people are at each other's throats today as a result of the narcissism of small differences. They are so distinct that they see in each other their gravest threat, or so similar that they see in each other their most serious threat. Charlottesville was in a result, really, of an episode that had happened a year prior in Sacramento, where you had a permitted demonstration of white nationalists rallying under fascist flags, and they were attacked by people rallying under hammer and sickles, and they literally knifed each other in the streets. It was America's Weimar moment, and we did not talk about it, and I don't know why. Perhaps we didn't really want to confront what was happening in front of our eyes, but we probably could have averted a lot of what happened in Charlottesville if we had confronted that in the moment.
So what, at what point do kind of right-wing identitarians become problematic? So, we know Richard Spencer is off limits. He's beyond the pale. But then what about Steve King, or what about Donald Trump, who trade in many of the same tropes, or and certainly the same kind of mentality?
Yeah. Well, they're all in the same, in varying degrees, offenses against meritocratic egalitarian thinking, because, you know, you would call this pretty standard, overt, old school white racism from the from Steve King in particular, a much more veiled form of victimization and collective thinking about people with racial traits as inhabiting some sort of a cohesive, distinct tribe from Donald Trump, both of which are offenses against the ideal that I'm talking about. So they're all problematic. It's probably helpful to draw different degrees, you know, for just as you would for somebody on the left. For somebody on the left who's attracted to these ideals of social justice is not the same thing as Minister Louis Farrakhan, who's an overt anti-Semite. They all inherit different degrees. And unfortunately, these extremes, these fringes, are looking more and more attractive to the center of the political spectrum. They're picking and choosing from these organizing principles, which have some value. And that's what the book hopes to address, because the knifing each other in the street thing is, I think, an outgrowth of an ideology that is incompatible with the American ideal. They want from American institutions things that they cannot deliver, this downward social leveling. And so when you erect these moral absolutes, these existential moral imperatives that the political system cannot deliver, one of two things happens to you. One, you withdraw, you become very disappointed in the system, you get very depressed, and you don't engage in the political process. The second is much more dangerous. That's to radicalize, to resolve to attack the foundations of these institutions because they are so unjust that they cannot be allowed to survive. And that's in part why I think we have seen a lot more violence in the street, political violence in this decade than we've seen in a generation. I think this is a trend.
Yeah, you know, at Reason, at various points among the editors, we discuss whether or not it's actually more violent or it just seems that way for various reasons. And I'm on the side that I think we're in a distinct phase. I mean, there is just, and also to the degree that, and you bring this up in the book, when Trump during campaign rallies was like egging people on to beat people up at his rallies. I mean, that's like, I don't even think the, you know, German-American Bund movement was doing that. Like, you know, they were more restrained than that. But one of the things that is kind of works through a lot of these questions and arguments and conversations and controversies is cultural appropriation. And you write, culture is not property and cultural transmission is not a zero-sum game. I want to ask you, because one of the most bizarre, again, this is something where I my secret belief is that we're living in a Philip K. Dick novel and, like, you know, we just got stuck in a really shitty timeline. You know, the blackface epidemic in Virginia, where it seems like everybody who's involved in, like, Democratic or Republican politics, right, who's over the age of about 55, spent a good portion of their college years or medical school years wearing blackface. Talk about cultural appropriation and why that's a flashpoint, and what is good cultural appropriation and what is bad cultural appropriation.
Yeah, so I think that the reckoning with blackface apparently is something you just did in the mid to late 20th century.
I know. It beggars the mind.
Yeah, it was much more. I mean, there was films like the Thomas E. Howell film.
Soul Man.
So, I mean, it was a little bit more, I guess, acceptable. But with that, I think that's a good thing. I mean, we're having sort of a social reckoning with that and identifying the ways in which it's offensive and sort of seeking some sort of penance for that and treating individuals as individuals who have created, who have done individual things that need to be accounted for. That to me is much more about reconciliation and restitution than revenge. And I think that that's valuable. Cultural appropriation, as it manifests in among the activist class who seek to police this sort of thing, is much different. Culture defies colloquial and material definitions of ownership, because once you transmit culture from one to another, nothing has been lost in the transaction. What cultural appropriation activists fear is that individuals will cheapen it by treating it in a way that doesn't cherish it. And that's a valid concern. The policing of it, however, has become something that's pretty tawdry. It manifests in things like activists in Portland attacking food trucks and the notion that success, and it's always success, needs to be policed and withdrawn from people who do not deserve it because they do not possess.
In Portland, you're talking about two women who traveled to Mexico and found a bunch of food recipes that they liked, and they opened a really popular food truck in Portland and then ended up shutting it down because they were accused of robbing.
Yeah, and you can see stories like this in the Portland Mercury just about every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. There's some sort of crusade against somebody who has enjoyed some sort of success in life that is perceived to be not their own because of their accidents of birth.
Yeah, and it's odd to think about those kinds of things. I was just thinking as you were talking about, you know, somebody like George Harrison and the Beatles got into Indian music, which, you know, and the story that is told is that I think during the recording of the Help sessions or Rubber Soul, but he a sitar was in the studio and he picked it up and started playing it like a guitar because that's what he knew, and then he liked the sound and he started getting into it. And you know, the Beatles songs are, you know, that use sitar music, and it created this subculture called raga rock, which is mostly kind of dumb, and it's a very you know, the people who were rock geniuses were still kind of dumb and they didn't really understand musical traditions. But that also brought, you know, Ravi Shankar, and like none of this stuff would have been known. Sure. if there hadn't been these kind of unauthorized pilferings of, you know, of vast, you know, millennia old musical traditions or cultural traditions.
And North America in particular is prone to cultural mixing. And yeah.
It seems to me it's the thing that is why we're better than Europe,
right.
to be quite honest, you
introduce that kind of heterogeneity into a gene pool and it makes it stronger.
Right.
The effect of this kind of cultural appropriation activism is really to create a sort of paranoia in its activists, because in part the social justice movement has grown so broad. As it's grown broader, strangely, its targets have become smaller. Increasingly, its activist class is focused in on tiny things, on pop culture, on music, on film, on comic books, on food truck proprietors, on individuals who transgress against whatever particular construct that the social justice movement holds dearly, but they limit their critique to people who are already predisposed to agree with them, because that demonstrates efficacy. It shows no power if you were to organize a mob around somebody who simply ignores you. You have to generate some sort of supplication, genuflection to these ideals. And so the social justice movement has increasingly focused on these people who are already predisposed to agree with the precepts and repent for sins against this theological ideal. And that's also probably why I think we've seen this phenomenon of woke capitalism, which has become now something that is really popular on the right and the left. Everybody wants their brands. Poll after poll shows it. And the brands that engage in it accrue some financial benefits from it, that they adopt these seemingly divisive stands on cultural issues, which are really impossible to address in the political process, you know, writ large, that properly understood. They're just cultural grievances.
So what's an example of that?
An example is the Nike's embrace of Colin Kaepernick, which really resulted in increased sales, and you know.
Do you think Kaepernick's protest was a good one, a smart one, or do you think, you know, was it? What's your take on that?
I don't really have a particular take. I think the grievances that have been identified by the Black Lives Matter movement are valuable. I think a lot of the ways in which they've gone about raising awareness of those ideas has been less so, has been counterproductive to the cause. Like I said. I say in this book, I make a pragmatic argument that a lot of these ideals are antithetical to what they want to achieve. What they want to achieve is less racial discrimination, less institutional discrimination, which I stipulate exists and is a real problem. But the methods they've adopted in order to address these issues are unproductive because they alienate individuals who can be counted on to achieve a critical mass of support in the voting population. An example of that is most recently the First Step Act, which was the Criminal Justice Reform Act, which is very much just that, a first step. Doesn't go as far as its activist class wanted to, but it nevertheless acknowledges, albeit tacitly, racial disparities in the criminal justice system. You would not have gotten there if the activist class had been haranguing Republicans and conservatives, white Republicans and conservatives, to sit down, shut up, and check their privilege.
Yeah, I guess so. But it's also true you don't get there without, you know, making a lot of noise. And I mean, both working within within the system and outside of it.
But
right?
It did so as the civil rights movement did so, by saying, you are not living up to your ideals. Mm-hmm. We want you to live up to these ideals that you profess to appreciate.
You know, we could have an argument about how does social progress actually happen, because I don't disagree with you in that. That's the genius of civil disobedience, is the appeal to the morality of the oppressor, to say you have said you want to be this, that, and the other thing, and you are failing on the job. But to go back to the letter from Birmingham jail, part of the context of that is that Martin Luther King was saying, look, you can either deal with me, and I'm kind of rational, or there's a lot of violent people who are exerting power and pressure and things like that. And he was talking about the Nation of Islam and other black radicals who were talking about armed revolution. So it seems, you know, you need the people that are inside. And, you know, in the First Step Act, one of the things that I don't think in the public view enough credit has been given to people like Pat Nolan and kind of Christian right-wingers who were actually pushing for all of these reforms for decades. But, you know, part of it is working through the establishment, and part of it is that threat that if you don't do something about this, much worse stuff is going to happen.
Right. And I don't necessarily think that if the civil rights movement had been typified by the kind of black nationalist militancy.
Oh, yeah. No, it would have been a disaster. I mean, it wouldn't have achieved
the progress.
By the same token, you know, it's, you know, to really kind of get, you know, segregationists, you know, pushed into a corner, it helps to have the Black Panther Party show up in Sacramento wearing guns legally, you know, and scaring the hell out of people, probably.
Yeah, sure.
As part of the melange that, or the, you know, the gestalt that changes.
So they can enjoy rights that are enjoyed by everybody
right.
equally.
Oh, yeah, no,
equally.
I agree with that.
Sure.
Yeah, no, and that for sure. Real briefly, more on this kind of, you know, when you were talking about capitalism as expressive of values, of the patrons or the people who created the companies. There's different levels of that. So you see, you know, something like Twitter kind of struggling to be as woke as Jack Dorsey, the founder, who like goes to, you know, tyrannical countries to have, you know, 2-week-long silent meditations. And then he's wrestling with whether or not he should kick off, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos or Alex Jones. But then you also have somebody like John Mackey, who wrote a book called Conscious Capitalism, the co-founder of Whole Foods, which puts into place, you know, like everything there is intentional. Everything there is ethical. It's sourced in a particular way. Do you find that to be problematic as well?
Well, I don't think it's problematic, but it's shallow. The phenomenon of woke capitalism is literally wearing your politics on your sleeve. Again, these aren't really political issues.
But is it to say, like, if you source stuff, you know, from, you know, small farms that are helping poor people in the developing world or something, is that just symbolic or is that actually transformative?
Well, I mean, it depends on whether or not the market supports that, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're essentially just generating market principles, if this is coming at a lower cost and mm-hmm. it is feeding a market demand, then yes, you are perpetuating mm-hmm. something that is, again, self-perpetuating. If you're just paying in order to generate or demonstrate your virtues mm-hmm. and your ideals, and there's a market demand for that as well, but it's less sustainable.
Well, yeah, and it certainly may not be self-perpetuating and whatnot, but we're also like at such a level now of, you know, symbolic interaction in everything we do, because 99% of people in America, at least, you know, have all of our basic needs are covered. So it's all symbolic transactions or virtue signaling in a lot of ways, I think.
I mean, maybe that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so much of this activism mm-hmm. become so militant and embrace this existential catastrophizing, you know, paradigms about what could happen in the event that this or the other phenomenon goes unchecked, is because so much progress has been made on so many fronts that the struggles of the past are no longer relevant, and so the moral urgency of our fathers and grandfathers aren't there.
At one point, you say that news consumers, and this kind of goes to the idea of speaking to your own group or people who already agree with you, that news consumers seek out sources that confirm their worldview, and that this is a problem. You know, and this is an old fear, it's always been an old fear, but it, you know, with the dawn of the kind of internet age and certainly the World Wide Web, this was a thing where you know, people would tailor their news just to whatever, you know, confirmation bias. Isn't that what readers of a commentary or Reason do? What's the right way and the wrong way to kind of confirm your bias?
Yeah. So seeking out stuff that you enjoy is good. There's no problem with you consuming information and in entertainment. And really, a lot of what we do is entertainment, and we're providing individuals. I mean, we're doing it in a compelling and informative fashion. But my objective is to make you forget about your circumstances for a couple of minutes that you're reading the post, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something I consume editorial opinion as entertainment. So I think probably other people do too. If you are cloistering yourself and you're in this little bubble, it has potentially psychologically damaging effects, because you are going to perceive your adversaries in a way that is caricatured. You're going to create cartoons of them in your imagination. And that's part of what we see on Twitter, in particular, with people who inhabit their own little self-reinforcing, bias-confirming bubbles, is that it incentivizes hyperbole and radicalism and leaping to conclusions and the least charitable view of what somebody believes or thinks. And that's the sort of thing that can be reinforced by selection bias in tailoring news sites to only consume what you want to believe and what you know, hearing your own opinion recited back to you. I mean, you wouldn't believe the kind of feedback I get when I'm on MSNBC. You know, I'm very much a not a human being. I'm perceived to be something that's much more vile. and that's just a construct that has been reinforced by these environments that people inhabit, so that when somebody breaks them, and I shouldn't say that's everybody, that's a small sliver of the reaction I get, but the reaction I get is the people who are moved to react, obviously, and they're going to be the most vocal about their reaction.
And you get a lot of the, like, why do they even have you on?
Yeah, it's a handful, but it's way over the top, like, out of control. You know, this is a vile human being, a racist, what have you. And it reduces an individual to a status that can't be considered an individual. You're no longer a complex person with a set of ideas and experiences that make a person an individual. You are a cartoon, a caricature, and that can be damaging because it creates the us versus them paradigm.
Let's talk a little bit about the experiences that made you who you are, your career. How old are you, and where did you grow up?
I'm 37. I grew up in New Jersey. Western New Jersey. I was born in Bronxville and then moved right away to Western New Jersey.
Is Bronxville where AOC is from?
She's from the Bronx.
She's
proper.
From the Bronx. Okay.
Yeah,
Bronxville. Did she move up there later? Or so? I don't know.
I don't know. I think
I probably
it's outside the boroughs.
Yeah. Okay.
And then moved to Western New Jersey and lived there for most of my young adult life.
What did your parents do?
My father was a doctor of pharmacology, and he was serial entrepreneur for
a drug and serial entrepreneur. He's,
sure.
He's starting to sound a lot like El Chapo.
Yeah, well, the different kind of drugs. Yeah. Unfortunately, the other kind,
the real
less
dangerous
fun kind.
Ones.
So he did that. My mother was a homemaker, and she was an artist by trade. And
I've read that you went to Drew University.
I went to
in
Drew
New
University
Jersey.
On a theater scholarship. I was a performing artist for most of my young life. I did like 35 musicals before I went to college.
Oh, really? What was your greatest role?
I think I would probably say Anatoly in Chess, which is an ABBA musical, which I really did enjoy.
That's is Chess, the big hit was One Night in Bangkok?
One Night in Bangkok,
yeah. And the world's your oyster.
It's probably the worst example of the whole score, though.
I don't know. That's the one.
It's like a rap
really,
song.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
And that's
departure
Tim Rice,
the
I think, was the lyricist.
Right.
Yeah, who
the score is gorgeous. Really recommend it. That one kind of leaves me cold.
I'm kind of anti Tim Rice and Lloyd Webber type stuff. But
So I was a sophomore in college when 9/11 happened, and I got really into the news cycle. I was sitting by the radio late nights, listening to conspiratorial broadcasts by two guys named John Batchelor and Paul Alexander. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that show, and I wanted to get into that space. So I took a internship in sales at WABC, and I convinced the PD at the time, Phil Boyce, to let me sit in with the show. And I stayed there for 4 years. It eventually became the John Batchelor Show, and I produced it. And I left in 2006. Navigated around the radio world and bounced around until a lot of jobs fell out from under me, and it was just a dispiriting existence in talk radio at the time. So then I went back to school and got a degree in international relations and public policy and security policy in the former Soviet space, and didn't do anything with it. Immediately went to a magazine called Campaigns and Elections magazine.
Oh, I know Campaigns and Elections.
Trade publication for people in the business of getting people elected, and that was a 1-year intensive grad course in domestic politics. And they sold the magazine from the publication that I was at in Princeton to a British publisher, and then I was out of a job there. I moved over to a pop culture site called Ology.com. No longer exists, but that was my first
foray. And is it, I mean, it just, it's not like Space Jam's website, like you can't call it up. It's
I mean,
just,
you could go into the Wayback Machine and you try to find it.
Yeah.
And I don't recommend it because my writing was pretty raw at the time.
What kinds of stuff were you covering there?
It was like SEO optimized, trying to get as many eyeballs pop politics, and you were putting out as many posts as you possibly could.
So, can you remember a post that you did?
I honestly can't. Okay, it was around 2011, but it was my first foray into opinion writing.
And then from there, did you go to where?
Mediaite.
Yeah.
Yes.
Explain what Mediaite is and what you learned working there.
Mediaite is a site founded by Dan Abrams, who hired me and to whom I am eternally grateful for that. It is a website that monitors cable news primarily, but television, news, radio, and what have you, less print, but mostly visual medium. And it tries to find the most interesting moments and clips those moments, and you write a little bit around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you post it up. So I had to do mostly that. But my very first day, I was told, very first assignment was to sit down and write the conservative response to something Tommy Christopher had written. Tommy Christopher was the site's pretty much, you know, iconic liberal blogger. I'd been reading him forever. So my very first assignment was to go up against this guy who in my mind had a stature well beyond my own. And that was, you know, essentially what my job has been ever since, is to punch up and write.
Mediaite is one of those websites that, you know, and I guess Abrams Media more broadly doesn't necessarily get discussed very much, but there's, you know, dozens of people who have filtered into different elements, and the site is still going strong.
So site is like, still strong.
Is there a politics to Mediaite? Just, you know, maybe not explicitly, and you were saying, you know, there was Tommy Christopher. There's always a liberal or two, and then there's like more conservative people. But is there a politics simply to the idea of watching cable news and calling people out either for stupid things or for smart things?
I guess. I mean, the idea of the site was to have as many voices as possible so that you could achieve nonpartisanship by virtue of having a lot of partisans on staff. So everybody would cover the partisan angles pretty well. And I think it did that. I think it still does that pretty effectively. There weren't a lot of people who did opinion per se, and there were some like quirky views that were expressed once in a while. But my role, I thought, was to write, you know, really serious conservative opinion pieces, and developed a bit of a footprint doing that.
And then you went to Hot Air after that?
And then I went on to Hot Air from
And
from
talk
that.
A little, you know, describe Hot Air. What do Hot Air people who work there say it is?
It's an opinion site associated with Town Hall at the time. I think it probably still is. But everybody works in various remote locations. So Ed's over here in the...
That's Ed Morrissey, the former blogger of the year from The Week who did Captain's Quarters.
Yes.
And
yeah, sure.
I love Ed, and he wrote a fantastic book about the 2016 election and shifting demographics on that. But mm-hmm. he was, he's like in Minneapolis, and he was working as a call center chief at, for a Target or something like that.
Yeah, we
and
didn't see each other that much, but we did once in a while.
I mean, he's to me, what I've always appreciated about him is, first off, I think he's thoughtful. We disagree on a lot of stuff, but he was the type of person that could only exist because when blogging happened, it was just like somebody who came from a totally non-gatekeeper background and won an audience because what he was doing was interesting to a lot of people.
And he's unfailingly civil and very sweet, and which is a really admirable trait, one not really rewarded very often in this space.
And then the other probably best-known person at Hot Air is the pseudonymous Ala Pundit. Do you know
another
who?
Another one from the era of bloggers.
Do you know who Ala Pundit actually is?
No, so I had a policy of plausible deniability. So if I was ever captured, you know, I could never really tell anybody anything. I don't know anything about the guy. I don't know where he lives. I know a lot of people there did, but I would never prod very much because I really
all
didn't
we really
know
is that he's a lawyer, right?
And I didn't know
funny.
That.
I assume he's a lawyer. Maybe I'm just making that up.
He's one of the most entertaining and insightful voices in the political space,
absolutely.
And nobody will ever know who he is.
Well, we'll see. We're working on that. You know, people thought they would never find out who Thomas Pynchon was, or, you know, the people behind Zero Hedge. You know, these things come out. We still haven't found out who wrote that anonymous anti-Trump New York Times.
I had forgotten about that until you just mentioned that.
So we've got a lot of digging to do.
But
so
there, I also met a couple of very important people from my career moving on who were at Town Hall at the time, Guy Benson and Mary Catherine Hamm. As well, and Katie Pavlich as well, who are all fantastic people and who helped me to move on. They actually recommended me, I think, for Hot Air at the time. So that they were very helpful
and now you're at Commentary, and Commentary got started around 1945. And what is its mission?
Well, it's changed over the years. I mean, at the time, it was a project of the American Jewish Committee, I believe, and it was only.
Or was it American Jewish Committee or Congress?
It's the AJC, something along those lines. Yeah, and it was a it came out of the period of the New York intellectuals, which sounds, you know, reasonably haughty, but that's really what they called themselves.
Yeah.
And they were the City University guys, and it was a much more center left publication in the mid century than it eventually became. It tracked really with the evolution of the New York intellectual movement from this sort of leftist to center left movement into what became neoconservatism. And so it's pretty much synonymous with that transformation.
Yeah, although, along with Public Interest, which I guess is no longer being published. That was founded by Irving Kristol. Commentary and Public Interest were kind of the house organs of neoconservatism, which back in the day also was, in many ways, was more focused on domestic policy and a kind of reevaluation of the what they considered the failures of the Great Society welfare state programs.
These internecine feuds among these groups is really well documented in a PBS documentary called Arguing the World, which I highly recommend. It's really enjoyable. So Commentary doesn't have an editorial board. Mm-hmm. We all have individual voices. We all write from those individual voices.
And this, by the way, I don't know why there's always a buzzsaw on Bleecker Street. I didn't know that there was so much lumber to cut.
That's very strange.
Yeah. But
weed whacking.
So you were saying, though, so there are no house editorials then. So like you're constantly writing. What is the biggest source of friction between you and your colleagues at Commentary?
Well, I'm, I guess, a little bit more libertarian on domestic policy issues than I guess most of my more conventionally conservative colleagues are. But, I mean, they're so narrow. We share so many convictions and generally broad first principles and worldview.
Is there an ethos to Commentary that this is largely a libertarian audience.
Yeah.
Why should, I think most of the listeners know Commentary or familiar with it, but, you know, make the pitch for why Reason readers should be interested in Commentary.
Oh, I'm not sure Reason readership would be interested in Commentary because the pitch is, I mean, I would be on the libertarian end of the spectrum, but for foreign policy views, all of us are generally interventionists.
Yeah. That even comes through in Unjust. You never miss an opportunity to say, you know, like we should be adding more troops somewhere.
Do I?
World. Pretty much. I feel maybe I'm reading between the lines.
I hope to avoid that because it's much more about, it's only and exclusively about America. I do not write about social justice from the perspective of other countries. I do not share that perspective. So I try to avoid that. I talk a little bit about England, but that's it. That's generally, we share a much more interventionist, extroverted foreign policy view. So that's pretty much the unifying principle, I suppose.
That's interesting. Let's come back to the book and to wrap up. We're talking about Unjust, Social Justice and the Unmaking of America with Noah Rothman. What are the ways forward? Because, you talk about a kind of American ideal of, a more proper understanding of a kind of Rawlsian veil of ignorance, or the idea that more people should be able to pursue what they want or have the means and the opportunity to become who they want to be as individuals. What are the ways forward to kind of capture, reconstitute that? Because is it just darkness, or is there a way to turn this around?
Yeah. So obviously, social justice has been with us for so long, and all of us have our own little personal social justice ideas and crusades that we think are certainly valuable. And everybody has their own identity politics. They think their identity politics is good and the other guy's is really dangerous. So I don't argue against any of that. My objective here is to stigmatize a very particular brand of identity politics in practice as social justice in its modern incarnation. And if you're with me through all these chapters, if you're going through the history of retributive social justice in this country and racial discrimination, the inviolable truths that they regard as existential threats to their ideas, the philosophical foundations, the really silly small things that constitute social justice activism today, the increasing appeal of victimization and the violence that manifests on the social justice movement. If you're with me through all that, and you get to the last chapter, and the last chapter recommends a way of thinking about addressing social justice activism from a pragmatic perspective, appealing to self-interest. So you presumably count yourself member of a political coalition. You have some ideas that you want to see manifest in politics. And in order to achieve that, you need to get 50+1 at the polls. And those are may consist of social justice priorities, but they're also probably much broader, foreign policy priorities, economic priorities, what have you. And that these ideas have become an obstacle to getting to 50+1. You might think they're valuable. I might think they're valuable, but they are making our lives harder. And there are ways in which we can appeal to historical models in order to achieve that. One of them is on the right, the stigmatization and isolation of the Bircher movement. Bill Buckley, Russell Kirk, and Barry Goldwater put out a real roadmap of how to do that, how to stigmatize ideas, not people. No political coalition with an interest in its own self-preservation would purge its own members. That's unrealistic. Mm-hmm. But you can isolate ideas. They provide a way to do that. For the left, you would probably look more towards what I describe as the way in which the communists and the organized labor movement were expelled from the coalition in the late 1940s, which was, again, another systematic effort to identify an idea and stigmatize an idea and say, this is making our lives more difficult. And finally, a re-emphasis on civic education. I am loath to identify legislative approaches to these because I don't think this is a political issue. This is much more a societal problem.
So it's not that the Department of Education needs to come up with a new national civics.
Well, it's possible that I'm not opposed to possibly thinking about tying education funding to a certain amount of hours spent mm-hmm. studying civics, not social studies, not diversity studies, civic education. I didn't read the Federalist Papers until I was a graduate student. That can't be. People, why would you think that the American ideal is worth preserving if you only know that it hasn't worked and it's constantly failed? We need to teach constitutionalism, how this government functions, the founding documents, not the founding principles too, but the founding documents as well, so that we have a proper understanding of what politics is capable of achieving in this country.
Just very quickly, in talking about the right and the left, broadly speaking, essentially saying, you know, they need to get their houses in order and, you know, either do what Buckley and a bunch of people did to kick the Birchers and other nuts out in the 60s, early 60s, and the left has to do that. Looking at 2016 at this point, I mean, Republicans seem absolutely terrified at the idea of telling Donald Trump to go fuck himself. Every declared candidate so far for the Democratic nomination for president signed on to the Green New Deal before they had even, you know, taken down the dumb fact that, you know, became a problem. I mean, do you have any expectation that this is going to happen?
No, not at all. Yeah. I fully expect that I will be waging a losing crusade here, but that doesn't make it valueless. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a noble mission that needs to be engaged with as much passion and fervor as you can if you really believe that the founding ideals and an egalitarian meritocratic society has not been improved upon and that efforts to improve upon it are making things worse, then there really is no alternative there. But no, I don't suspect that this is a mass appeal movement that I'm talking about because identitarianism is really popular and identitarianism makes people feel good about themselves. Again, it absolves you from a lot of the mistakes you've made in life or the conditions that you can overcome if you only applied a certain amount of moxie to it. I mean, that's a hard sell. So I expect that this book will be not well received by a lot of the people I'm trying to reach. I'm still trying to reach them nevertheless.
You should read it with a bottle of moxie, right? The soda, which is hideous tasting, but is available.
Spiced rum would help it out.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I have been talking with Noah Rothman. He is the author of Unjust Social Justice and the Unmaking of America. And you can also go to Commentary Magazine's website and check out all of his writing. Noah, thanks for talking.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been The Reason Podcast, and I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Google, at Apple, at Spotify. Go to reason.com and sign up there on our RSS feed, or go to SoundCloud. We're all over the place. Thanks for listening.